Welcome to another episode of Gangland Wire, True Crime Stories. My name is Aaron. I'm here with retired intelligence unit detective, Gary Jenkins.
Well, welcome back. We had a little miscue there, folks. Sorry about that. Welcome back to episode 3 of The Gang That Couldn't Detonate the Bomb Right. This is your host, Gary Jenkins. Aaron and I are sitting here in the deep, dark confines of Studio 4, the home studio for the Big Dumb Fun Show. My friend, producer, and co-host, Aaron Gnerk, is here. Say hello, Aaron.
Hello, Aaron.
You know, to listen to independent music and then learn about the independent film scene, visit www.bigdumbfunshow.com. Aaron has some fine stuff. You know, I found out that Aaron receives and plays music created by independent musicians from all over the United States. So tune in and listen to some original cutting-edge stuff and maybe help discover the next Black Eyed Peas or Alabama Shakes. You know, and also don't forget to go to my website, www.ganglandwire.com. You might want to check out the DVD, Gangland Wire, that I created. You also might want to go to my blog. I've blogged about organized crime for the last couple of years, and there's some interesting stories in there, and there's some interesting comments. I've gotten some angry relatives commenting on my stories, and I've got some cryptic comments from people who know more than they should about the mafia. Actually, I had the intelligence unit sergeant was reading that, and he got hold of me and said, you need to get a hold of this guy. I won't even say what the moniker he uses, but you need to get a hold of this guy. I want to talk to him. And you know, I've never gotten that guy. I tried to get him to show up at a screening I had at the Screenland Crown Center, and he never would show up. But and he hasn't. I haven't heard from him for a long time.
He hasn't posted on your Facebook
he
since.
He hasn't posted book or posted on my actually replied to my blog is what he was doing, replying to a blog entry. And he hadn't replied for quite a while. I wish he'd. If you're out there, you know, get hold of me, bub. We can maybe work something out.
Well, you also have an app.
I have an app. Yes, I created the Kansas City Mob Tour app. And you can sit in the confines, the safe and warm confines of your own home and take a mob tour of Kansas City. Or it's got maps, and you can go out and drive around Kansas City and see the places where these mobsters lived, where they fought, where they killed each other, where they made love, where they gambled, where they drank, and all kinds of, and ate, and all kinds of other fun stuff. And I make interesting recommendations on restaurants. One of them in particular, you might see a mob guy, two of them. You might see a mob guy or two in there. So
In the photo on the wall.
Not just in the photo on the wall. No, I walked into one of these places, and I don't want to demean any place particularly, because some people take this as demeaning. But I walked into this one place down there on, and we won't say the name of it, but it was on Admiral Boulevard, and every mob bookie in Kansas City was at a big round table, just having a merry old time, talking and eating Italian food, and having fun. So, you know, check out my mob tour, Kansas City mob tour. I think you have to type in, search for Kansas City mob tour at your Google app and or Google Play and iTunes store to get that. It's only $1.99, cheap at 10 times the price. Well, Aaron, you know, we left off last week last time we were together. It's been 2 weeks now since we got together.
They may not know that.
We left off with Nick Zavella being the head of the La Cosa Nostra crime family here in Kansas City, and his crime family, his brother primarily, Cork Zavella, is his consigliere, and his underboss, Tuffy DeLuna, Carl Tuffy DeLuna, and they're engaged in open warfare with the Carl Spiro faction. And they were a group of young Turks that want to take over the mob in Kansas City. And if you remember, one of the Spiro faction members, a really bad character called the Arab, had robbed some gambling money from a Savella bookie. It was about $10,000. And the Savella faction had ambushed Carl and his brother, his two brothers, Mike and Joe, at the Virginia Tavern, and killed Mike. And Carl is paralyzed from his waist down, and Joe was wounded. And shortly after this ambush at the Virginia Tavern, both Carl and Joe were back in business. And Carl is paralyzed, but he has just bought a Cadillac. Seemed like it was a 76 Cadillac, and he had hand controls put on it so he could drive around. I remember following him one day, and he went to the a place over by KU Med Center, and we figured out later it was dialysis. He had to go for dialysis every other day because he didn't have a kidney function anymore. But he still had.
And you kept following him, and he would go over there, and you're like, "Well, he must be here for a reason."
Right. That's what we thought. We kind of laughed at ourselves. We said, "Well, what is this word? I don't even know what the word renal meant." We knew it had something about renal in the name, and so we checked around. We found out it was a place you'd go for dialysis, and so whenever he'd get close to that, we'd just back off. We knew he'd be there a couple hours, and then pick him up whenever he left. But. You know, a little aside story. I had an informant. I talked about an informant last week that was able to overhear Carl Spiro making some plans when he was working at a used car dealership.
Yeah, they would meet in the back room of a used car dealership.
And he heard about this really bad dude called the Arab coming to town. And he told me, he helped me find out what the Arab's name was. And he advised me this guy was a very scary dude. And he was. And if you remember, I had just approached this guy cold. I just walked up to him and said, you know, I understand you used to work at this, what is the name of it? AA Auto Service, or Auto Sales, I think was the name of it, something like that. And he started talking to me because he was scared. And I didn't know what he was afraid of. Well, you know, this guy was, he was about 6'4". And he had been a very tough guy at one time, but he had never really been a real deal criminal. He'd always been in the tow truck business and car repo business and body shop business, and those are tough occupations, especially the repo business. He always carried a gun. I remember that. And he was about 6'4" and about 250 pounds, but he was getting old, and he had one eye. I'll never forget. He had one eye that. Had a big scar over it, and all you could see was white in the pupil, and there was no pupil, just see white in his eye. He was scary looking too, but he had lost.
This was
it.
The informant that you recruited,
right?
So he was a kind of a tough guy.
He was. He had been a tough guy. He had not really ever been a criminal, except minor things. He said he used to be able to palm dice. He could switch dice in the middle of a card or a dice game and throw in some phony dice, make a few passes, and then switch the dice back out and never get caught. Although he did get caught a couple of times, that may be how he got his eye messed up. He never told me how he got his eye messed up.
But he wasn't even working at this car dealership anymore.
He wasn't working there
anymore.
But
he had been there at a time when these other people, when Carl Spiro was meeting.
Correct. And so I knew he had a secret, and he started telling me these things, and I finally got him to tell me what his secret was. After he got comfortable with me, and he kind of hinted at it, and I said, you know, his name was John. He's dead now, I'm sure, but I won't say his last name. And he was, you know, it was interesting. He was married to an ex-wife of a Kansas City, Missouri police officer who had recently retired at that time. Anyhow, John said, you know, he said, I'm going to tell you something. And I said, you know, whatever you tell me, I don't care what you did, unless it's murder, I'll cover you on it. I'll make sure you're not going to get charged with it because you have helped me out so much. And he said, well, he said, and this is what he thought I knew, and I didn't know this. He said, Carl Spiro stole a bulldozer. And he stole it from over here off of Johnson Drive, just east of or west of I-35. And from a construction site, and he was taking it to sell it to somebody down by Butler, Missouri, and the truck hauling the trailer with the bulldozer on it broke down. And he said they knew I had a big tow truck, so I went down to haul that broken-down truck and with the bulldozer attached to it on to where they wanted it to go. And I said, oh, now I get it. And so I went back and checked, and we went to Johnson County and Sheriff's Department, and I think that was Shawnee Police Department, and found that, lo and behold, about a year before that, a bulldozer had come up missing at a construction site right exactly where he said it was. And so then we went down into Bates County and Vernon County. I believe it ended up being in Bates County. And
you're tracking down this bulldozer.
Well, I'll find the bulldozer. And John went down with us, myself and an old-time detective who was one of the original members of the intelligence unit, Ray Kinney, who was one of these old philosopher kind of guys. But I learned more about being an intelligence detective from him than anybody else. And so Ray and John and I went down there one day, and we we looked around, and he remembered about what road it was on, and we went down there, and then we kind of looked around and tried to figure out where it was he towed it to, but it was at night when he went back down there, and we weren't sure. We thought we had the farm spotted.
You were just driving around just in the vicinity around. Of looking for any,
for you know
a bulldozer.
He had, well, not the bulldozer, but just the farm that he took it to.
And, like you're assuming it was still on the truck.
Yeah, he had towed the truck and the bulldozer to a farm with his tow truck. And so, but this had been several months before, almost a year before.
That he had done this.
Yeah. And so we really weren't too sure, so we did a little double check, and we found that the sheriff of this county was maybe a little bit shady. So we didn't want to go to the sheriff.
Because it was his farm that the bulldozer was on?
Well, we didn't know that. We just knew that the sheriff had a reputation among other sheriffs, and the highway, especially the highway patrol, as being a shady character. So, you know, in the country, you've got criminals in the country. It's just like in the city. You got, mm-hmm. But they rustle cows and steal hogs and steal farm equipment and do things like that. And so we found a retired Kansas City, Missouri police officer who was living down there, who had become a part-time deputy for the sheriff, and we trusted this police officer, so we went to him, and his name was Bill Gallhofer. He's probably dead now, too, and went to Bill and told Bill what we had, and he had a name right away. And so I kind of backed off of it. We went to the FBI and said, okay, here's what we got. We think this is the guy that's got the bulldozer. Here's a local deputy who can kind of steer you the right place. And we're going to turn it over to the FBI but understand that this is an informant. We do not want him exposed. And so they went down there, and they figured out who had that bulldozer, and I never did get the name. And they actually went on a farm. He had turned around and sold it to somebody else, and they recovered the bulldozer and returned it to the people that lost it.
Does that happen very often, people stealing something like that, like a piece of construction equipment,
sure.
A bulldozer?
There's still a huge market for Bobcats. Bobcats are portable and easy to steal and easy to sell. You could go out in the country and sell stolen Bobcats all day long, because who's ever going to check the serial numbers on a bulldozer?
Now, the guy that your informant, he was just the guy running the tow truck. How
right.
did you were trying to trace this back to Carl Spiro, weren't you?
Right, right. And you know,
so
we only had his testimony.
On him.
Sure. It was all dependent on him, and we'd only have, if we were to charge Carl Spiro with it, we would only have his testimony that Carl was there, except for the guy that bought it. Now, we'd have to turn him. So what we did is the Bureau did is they got the bulldozer back, and they did a little grand jury on it, and then they just let it drop, just like it. You know, just let it go. And it's one that Carl got away with because the informant was still too valuable to expose. And we never really got back around.
Because the informant had other information that was relevant to what was going on.
And he was still working in the area where these mob guys were. He had a body shop of his own by then, but he was just a few blocks and from this car dealership where a mob guy was the owner of it, a guy named Joe Civiliano, and other mob guys were still going out there. They were still hanging around. They were still meeting each other. And so my informant could go in and out of that place. Now, they wouldn't really talk to him very much, but he could at least let us know what was going on. He had other fingers and other pies in the city that he could help me out with. So it was the long game. We wanted the
we
long
don't know,
game
was he
him.
Maybe still involved in criminal activity? He wasn't telling you. He just said,
yeah, if he was,
I did
he
this
wouldn't
one
tell
thing.
Me. That's always the conundrum of working. I've got several moral dilemmas that we'll talk about over the rest of this these different episodes that you have with dealing with informants, for example. How much do you let them do? I can't, as an officer, I can't knowingly help them commit a crime. But if they commit one and they get caught, I can go in and try to bail them out and make sure that they don't get charged. And I've done that several times. And, you know, it starts with traffic tickets and maybe even a larger crime. But if they commit
once
too many
crimes.
Once
they realize they can get away with it.
Right.
Because they're your informant.
If they commit too many crimes, you got to let him go. Yeah. We had a guy we let go once. He just kept doing burglaries and kept doing burglaries. And so the original crime of burglary that we had him jam up on, it was a sure dead conviction. We had asked the prosecutor to withhold charging him with that. And so we just went back to the prosecutor and said, okay, let it go. Charge him with that burglary. You got his fingerprints on the inside. We've got a confession in a roundabout way, but we got a confession from him. Let's go with it. And he got on the stand
he didn't expect to be put up there on the stand.
He didn't expect to be charged. But, you know, we told him, said, you know, man, you keep doing burglaries. We charge you now because we told you you can't continue to commit crimes that we know about. And so, you know, he was crying the blues. He actually cried to the jury how the policeman promised him that he wouldn't be prosecuted on this, and he helped us out, and now he's being prosecuted. So, you know.
Well, because he kept committing crimes.
He kept committing crimes, yeah. It's always a moral dilemma. How much do you let him do? And there's been policemen and agents who have gone to jail because they let him do too much because your ego gets in the way. It's an interesting fine line that you walk whenever you got to deal with informants and in gathering intelligence, and how much do you let them, how far do you let them go, and how valuable are they? But anyhow,
going back to Carl Spiro, and you've been following him.
We're following Carl. We know that Nick Civella has ordered that Carl be killed. We know that, and so what we don't know, and I'm going to do a little jump back here. What we don't know is the Civella brothers have already made one try to kill Tuffy DeLuna. They did. They drove by his house just as he was getting out of his car, walking up to the front door, and fired at him. They fired a shotgun, we believe.
They were just driving by?
They were just driving by, but they missed him. And detectives, or somebody called somebody out, and they went out and investigated, and they saw a pattern of gunshot bullets in the front of Tuffy's house, but he would not confirm or deny that anybody was shooting at him. What he did say was a lot of cars traveled up and down Gladstone Boulevard, and in other words, it was just a drive-by shooting, and they missed him. And so,
how far was it? If you were there on the scene,
well, I mean, to the front of his house from the street.
So the street was how far is that?
Oh, it's probably 25 yards, maybe. It wasn't a big house set way back up.
It was relatively close to the streets.
It was a normal kind of house, relatively close. He just missed him. He just wasn't very. He's probably drunk. It's open warfare between the Civellas and Tuffy and the Spiros.
Well, do you think that was Carl or Joe?
That was Joe. I'll tell you a little story later how we know it was Joe. There's at this point in time, we end up with an informant. A guy named Lyle Neal. Now, Lyle Neal was a professional criminal. He was not Italian, but he was a professional criminal of the ilk that Carl had been recruiting. And if you remember, Carl was recruiting non-Italians to be part of his mob, and he was going to, telling them he was going to take over the Civellas' gambling and their stolen property locations, where they would retail out stolen property. So
he was recruiting all these Peckerwoods.
He was a Pecker. Lyle Neal was a Peckerwood. You're right. He wasn't even half Italian. And you know, I look back at his rap sheet, and it started out right. He was 18 years old. He had started out doing burglaries and assaults and things like that. And in July of 1974, Lyle Neal had shown up at a drug distribution operation during a raid by undercover officers. And Neal and a guy named Denny Duffy exited Neal's car, and the undercover officers were already up on the front porch. And as they walked up toward the residence, these officers stopped them. This Denny Duffy, he didn't realize that these were cops at this point in time.
They weren't in uniform?
They were not in uniform. This was the old pop squad, and these guys...
But these guys were just about to basically go in on a house.
Right. They were already in the house. They were searching. Oh. Bobby Arnold and Big Red Horner were out in front. When these Lyle Neal and Duffy pull up, they're going into the drug house to buy drugs, or maybe they got something they want to sell to them. It was a kind of a distribution point. And Bobby and Big
Duffy?
Red, they got their guns out already, and so this Duffy character, he has a gun, and he pulls a gun, and once he pulls a gun, he's bought and paid for it. They just opened up on him, and they kill Duffy. Arrest Lyle Neal, and they arrest everybody else in the house.
That was in the house.
Was in the house, yeah.
But no one else was killed.
Nobody else was killed except this Duffy, and that was all outside the house.
Was anybody charged with murder in the incident?
Well, you know, they weren't. Nobody was charged with...
But it was an officer that shot and killed Duffy.
Right, and his only crime was he pulled a gun off the officer, and now he's dead. Lyle Neal did not pull a gun. He didn't have a gun. But what was of interest was inside that house, Joseph Spiro Jr. was in there. So Neal has this connection to the Spiros from way back. And this is the son of the nephew of Carl Spiro and the son of Joe Spiro. Lyle Neal leaves the short city shortly after that, and you know, he goes to Canada. It's kind of interesting. Now, who knows? This is like a guy from over in Northeast and been a two-bit criminal all his life, but he ends up in Canada, and he does a burglary up there, and he gets caught, and he serves a two-year sentence, and then he comes back to Kansas City. He gets back to Kansas City in 1976, and he's arrested for transportation of stolen securities, and he does a two-year sentence in the federal penitentiary up at Leavenworth. And he's back in Kansas City by 1978. 1978, Lyle Neal shows up running a prostitution service as an escort service, which was a cover for prostitution. It's called On-Call Escorts. And at the time, I was working an escort service because we wanted to make a case on the guy that owned it, a guy named Bob Roma, because he was an underling of another mob guy named Jimmy Duarte. And I realize there's a lot of names. You don't need to remember these names, because it's not really important on down the road, but we had set up a sting operation at the old downtown Holiday Inn, and we had the vice unit call the Big Apple Escort Service and request 10 girls for a convention of used car dealers. Big Apple couldn't get 10 girls together, so he called in Lyle Neal. Somehow there was a connection between them. These guys are all connected. And his on-call escorts, and he provided several girls, and they showed up,
And he showed up with them?
With the girls, just like the owner of the Big Apple Escort Service showed up, and with his girls, and these, this vice sting operation, they got about 10 or 15 old-timey policemen. These guys were all, at the time, were all 50, 60 years old.
And they're all in a room like they're...
And they're all in a room like they're used car salesmen, and they're all drinking. They spent about $150 on booze that night, and these guys are all drinking. They got music. They're dancing with these whores and having a merry old time, just like they were their girlfriends.
Like they're actually used car salesmen.
And they're used car salesmen, and they're starting to make...
That sounds like a tough job.
Right. They're starting to make the deals, you know, for the sex for hire. You got to get a price and an act. So as they're talking to these girls and drinking
with
them...
Does money actually have to exchange hands?
No, you just get
a price and an act.
Now, whores are usually pretty cagey about that. They'll say, well, you know, what do you want me to do? And you say, well, what will you do? And you try to get them to give the act.
Are all of these officers wired?
No, nobody was wired.
Their personal testimony.
Personal testimony, yes. So, you know, what happens
Your Honor, I was there drinking.
The undercover, and they're drinking, the undercover and the prostitute, you know, that can be, you know, hopefully they won't perjure themselves. And usually what happens is the officer will tell the story right, and then the prostitute will go in and just cop a plea and get some kind of probation and a fine, or maybe a short jail sentence if she has several priors. But
you're really going after the...
We're really going after the head of this one escort service, and he just happened to call Lyle Neal in. We didn't even know who Lyle Neal was. He'd fallen off the radar. He was off the radar, and this is how he comes back onto the radar. And this put heat on him because we charged him. He showed up with the girls, and they ended up charging him with, I think they called it pandering to prostitution. That was what you charge a pimp with, and which he was a pimp. And so he gets nervous, and this brings a lot of heat down on him, and he thinks it's going to be they charged him in state court, and everybody knew it was going to be dismissed except him.
Well, he had priors, so...
And he had priors, yeah. And so he contacts a vice sergeant named J.D. Johnson and said, you know, man, I need to get you guys off my back. And J.D. says, well, you give me something and I'll help you with this case. And knowing that they were going to end up dismissing all these cases in the end anyhow, what we really were working on was the long game again, and that was on Bob Roma, who owned Big Apple Escort Services, which, because there's a whole big other operation, which is a whole other story on that, and Lyle Neal just drifted in the middle of it, but it did make him into informant for J.D. Johnson.
Now, they would just continue to allow him to operate a prostitution ring?
Sure.
Because he was a good informant?
Sure.
Now, how do you quantify good informant in terms of valuable, actionable intelligence? Is he maybe just stringing you along?
Sometimes they string you along, but you know, you can't stop a prostitution service anyhow. How do you stop it? You arrest a couple of girls, and then they get bonded out, and maybe they go to some other escort service, and he hires a couple other girls. And you got to get the girls to come back and testify that, that he was taking part of the money, and
they're
they
not
going to
do that.
They're not going to do that. It's you know, it's just a game that we play, and I'm not sure why sometimes, but we do, and we always did, and I guess they still do. I don't know, but you know, that's always the ethical dilemma at the
time.
Who
comes up with that duty? Like, hey, we've got to bust some prostitutes. Let's get the alcohol and get a room and pretend like we're salesmen.
Well, that
someone's
was
like,
fun,
that sounds like a great idea.
Actually, Aaron, that was my idea. Me,
it was your
me
idea?
And another guy from Vice. I can't remember what his name was. That was our idea. I went to him and I said, you know, here's what I want to do. I want to get every prostitute the Big Apple Escort Services got and get them arrested at one time and maybe get him or his manager close by, and I want to create a case that shows that he is running a prostitution service, not a simple escort service for mm-hmm. visiting businessmen.
And so by and getting so all of his
they bought into it. You know, they thought it was a good idea. It
was Big Apple Escort operated by somebody that was...
He was connected to a mob guy, yeah. It was a mob operation. Lyle Neal's operation was his own operation, not really a mob operation. But Big Apple was a mob operation. And the owner of it...
But it wasn't a Spiro operation.
No, it was Jimmy Duarte, another mob guy. And so, you know, you got to have a scorecard to keep the players straight sometimes. But anyhow, it did bring enough pressure on Lyle Neal to start snitching to JD a little bit. And pretty soon, that relationship really did pay off with JD. Lyle Neal had been recruited sometime during this point in time by Carl Spiro to work with Joe Spiro, the father of Joe Spiro Jr., who Lyle Neal had known since he was a kid, and they knew each other as teenagers and young thugs. So he'd been recruited by Carl to be part of his new gang. And, you know, he didn't say too much until May of 1979, and J.D. Johnson had left the Vice Unit. He was assigned to the White Collar Crime Unit, which was a small unit. It's kind of like the intelligence unit, only they didn't just gather intelligence. They actually went out and tried to make cases on or professional criminals, and usually not on mob guys, because it's too hard to do that with local people. We didn't have the laws or the grand jury to bring them in and get testimony. We didn't have wiretap laws, but they could work on these intermediate level criminals and like Lyle Neal and other people like that, and use people like Lyle Neal to go and work on professional burglars and maybe get them set up and follow them around and catch them in the act.
And you call them white collar crimes?
It was called a white collar crime
because they're professional criminals.
Yeah, right. I'd say that was it. You know, you just pick out a name. You know, it was a special investigations division after that. So, you know, they just pick out a name and called it the White Collar Crime Unit. But Lyle Neal called J.D. up, and he said, and he told him about Joe Spiro is trying to kill Tuffy DeLuna, and that Carl Spiro has something to do with it, but Carl Spiro never shows up. But Joe seems to be in charge, but he knew Carl was behind it, because Carl was smart enough not to expose himself to these lower-level people. By that, he had recruited him, but he didn't expose himself...
By actually doing the work.
By actually doing anything with him, but Joe was doing things with him. It was all at Carl's direction. There's no doubt about that. So Neal tells this story. He said, you know, he said, Joe told me that he had his cousin. He driving by Tuffy's house one night a few months before, and he shot a shotgun at him twice as he was approaching the front door. And if you remember, we knew that had happened. We just didn't know who did it.
Yeah, and when it happened.
Exactly. And now Lyle Neal says, this happened and Joe Spiro did it, and we know that something happened exactly like that, so it makes his intelligence good.
Now,
makes him
Lyle
a good informant.
Does Lyle Neal know that because he was with Joe?
Joe Spiro told him the story. Bragging told him the story. Matter of fact, you know how guys sit around and tell stories? Well, they sit around and tell stories about their derring do and their different previous actions, and everybody likes to tell war stories. So what is really interesting and funny, and Neal said that, you know, he said Joe kind of laughed about missing Tuffy, but he said, you know, it was worth it just to see the look on his face. And I could see that, you know. It would have been worth it just to see the look on his face, because they hated Tuffy. They knew by then that Tuffy DeLuna had led that raid on the Virginian. They knew that without a doubt. Tuffy was the guy that masterminded that raid on the Virginian.
But you don't think they missed on purpose?
He didn't miss on purpose. He just was drunk, probably. he just missed. You know? Yeah. You don't always hit. And he missed him, but it was worth it just to see the look on his face. That's a classic. Well, now, J.D. has a detective named Clark Hamilton, who I did some interviewing of, and you'll hear some interviews, which we're getting ready to play one here in a minute. It's I think the name of it is Clark Shoots interview. But I'll tell you a little bit about Clark Hamilton. He was really one of the best detectives we ever had. He unfortunately, a few years after that, he sat down. This is sad. He sat down in a chair, and the chair broke, and he fell, and he received a back injury, and he ended up having to be retired early with a disability. He could not perform the full functions of a police officer after that. So he had to retire early, but he was a good one. He was involved with everything that we ever did that was big time. He was involved with the sting operation. We did a big sting operation with the ATF, and he knew these mob guys. He knew these periphery guys. He knew them all. But J.D. put Clark Hamilton in charge of Lyle Neal to operate him on the streets. After they knew that they could use Lyle Neal, and Lyle Neal was telling them enough about this Spiro plot to kill Tuffy and Luna that they wanted to keep total control. Now, Clark will say he was really hard to control, and he would go tell J.D. one thing and tell Clark another, and he was trying to do his own little bits of action on the side and yet keep himself covered, and it's always difficult to deal with a guy like Lyle Neal, but anybody can.
Because he has no real allegiance to anybody.
No real allegiance to anybody, and they didn't really have a real hammer on him. They didn't have a big case on him. He was just volunteering himself in order to keep himself covered.
Because he was still running his prostitution ring.
Right, right. He was doing that and probably selling dope, too. But we knew enough that he was in on the inside of this plot to kill Tuffy Luna. And so it was worth it to try to deal with him. So play a little bit of that interview at Clark Hamilton. I think it's called Clark Shoots.
Lyle Neal indicated that towards the first part of 79... Tuffy DeLuna was returning home from wherever, and as he crossed his front yard, Joe Spiro fired two shots with a high-powered rifle, attempting to kill him.
That's the problem with dealing informants. Like, right there you saw a discrepancy. He said a high-powered rifle, which anybody knows anything about a high-powered rifle, it is one shell. So it should be two holes, when in fact it was a shotgun, because there was a pattern of a bunch of little holes or little indentations into the wood and it was a brick house, and it was a pattern from a shotgun.
Like pellets,
right. And that's always a problem in dealing with informants, because they tell you one thing one time and tell you another thing another time, and they don't get the facts right.
Well, when you cross-check the facts, you're just trying to determine the truth, and the fact is it's an informant, they may not actually be telling you the truth.
Right, right. And you always got to check on them, always, constant check on them, because they're playing a game that you don't know what they're playing two or three games, and you don't know what, like you said, Aaron, their allegiance is to nobody particularly, just to themselves. Otherwise, they wouldn't be informants, would they? But, Neal told Clark and J.D. that he was worried because the Spiros were including him in on the plans for future attacks directly on Tuffy Luna and other Sabella mobsters. And he also said he had been told that Carl Spiro had found a bomb maker to make a bomb, and he had about 100 sticks of dynamite. And this bomb was to be detonated by the remote control device. That's a hard sentence to say. Say that three times. And he told us about another member of the Spiro crew, a man named Conrad Metz. Well, interesting enough, Conrad Metz owned a bar called Little Caesars, and it was about a half a block west of the Villa Capri bar at Independence and Prospect. And the Villa Capri bar, that was the nighttime headquarters for all and meeting place for all the Sabella faction. And I spent many an hour driving by that place, writing down Sabella and other Sabella underlings' license plate numbers, and sometimes we'd go in and have a beer, and we'd always see him sitting in the back and in this particular table and talking. And
is that the Villa Capri in Metcalf?
It's not the Villa Capri at Metcalf. I always make sure that that you know it's not. I don't want to denigrate the Villa Capri in Metcalf. This was a whole separate operation.
This was over in the northeast.
In the northeast part of the Kansas City. And
off of like 3rd and...
It was 6th Street, Independence Avenue, and about Prospect. Here are a lot of the wiretaps that I got from the FBI to put in the movie. You want to go buy Gangland Wire at www.ganglandwire.com. So, you know, we're working on the Spiro War. And so by now, it's May of 1979. The Virginia Tavern ambush was on May 16th of 1978. This is almost a year to the day after the Virginia Tavern ambush, where Mike was killed and Carl was paralyzed and Joe was wounded. And Joe has told Lyle Neal that he wants to make a statement on the anniversary of the death of Mike Spiro. He knows for sure it was Tuffy DeLuna led that raid by then. So he wants to do something on Tuffy by May the 16th, and this is the first week of May when Lyle Neal's reporting this. And I hate to leave you hanging at this cliff, but, you know, it's time to quit and for now. So just think about Lyle Neal. This guy is caught in the middle. He can't walk away from the Spiros at this point in time. He knows way too much, unless he wants to just leave the city and disappear. He doesn't want to participate in this killing because there's no edge for him. There's no money for him in this. They're just intimidating.
This is revenge.
This is revenge for the Spiros. And
well, but if they kill Tuffy, then you know it's they're moving towards trying to take over.
Well, but they're never going to take over. Lyle Neal's smart enough. No, they're never going to take over anything.
Maybe, and that's why he became a snitch.
Right. They're not smart enough to take over gambling and true organized crime operations. None of them are. I'll probably have all kinds of bad emails and death threats from the Spiros. They listen to this, the relatives, the descendants.
And they'll say, yes, they were capable of taking it over.
Yeah, taking you out.
They were going to just step in and take the skim off. Were the Spiros even aware of the
they
skim in
Vegas? They
weren't
even aware of the skim. They had no idea about the skim.
Like everything going on really in Kansas City was pretty small.
That was small potatoes compared to the skim. The skim was $40,000 a month. When we took them off at the end, we got $80,000, and that was 2 months' take from the Tropicana alone, and that was just one hotel. The going to Chicago and then divvied back partly to Kansas City from the Stardust, the Hacienda, the Frontier, and the Riviera was, I don't know how much, probably $100,000 a month, and it had been going on for several years. So what we're talking about is small potatoes and dangerous stuff. But
guys like the Spiros, they're not afraid of pulling the trigger.
They're not afraid of pulling the trigger. Now, Tuffy wasn't afraid of pulling the trigger either because he's the one that dropped the hammer on Carl Spiro with the shotgun as he ran across the street. So, you know, they weren't afraid of it either. But Spiros, they weren't sophisticated enough to run this scheme. They didn't have the contacts, the relationships with the Teamsters Union. They had relationships with the Chicago mob. They didn't have relationships with the Milwaukee mob or the Cleveland mob. They were just some young Turks that wanted revenge and did it under the guise of, we're going to take over. But
they had 100 sticks of dynamite.
They had 100 sticks of dynamite, and they truly had a remote control device, and they truly had a bomb made. But Lyle Neal, he knows by now he's not working with the sharpest tools in the toolbox. And he knows they're clouded with emotion, and that's not a good place to commit a murder and get away with clean.
Yeah.
No way can you commit a murder and get away with it clean when you're doing it on an emotional basis. Professional basis is a different deal.
Well, they're never going to get the Savellas or Tuffy DeLuna in a car by themselves.
No, they got a cowboy it, just like Tuffy had to do down to Virginia, and they got a cowboy it, or they got to use a bomb and then... be able to figure out how to use the bomb correctly and then get Tuffy in his car where Tuffy doesn't look around his car before he leaves. Many times he had a remote control starter like the rest of them by this point in time, so they couldn't wire it to the ignition.
And he would park his car in his garage.
Most of the time at night, not always, but he'd look underneath it and he had the remote control starter. And so you look underneath.
Wasn't Tuffy the one he found a tracking device?
He found a tracking device on it because he had an alarm set up on it and caught, almost caught an FBI agent putting it on. FBI agent ran down the street when we served a search warrant on Tuffy's house, we recovered the tracking device. So, you know, let's stop now. And in the next exciting installment, we're going to hear about the continuing attempts to kill Tuffy Luna and the gang that could not detonate the bomb right. I'm not really giving everything away, but just a little bit of it. And remember, go to www.ganglandwire.com. You got anything to final words of wisdom there, Aaron?
Nope. We'll have more with Gangland Wire, true crime stories, when we come back on the next episode with retired Kansas City, Missouri, Intelligence Unit Detective Gary Jenkins. Words from the mouth of the man who was there.